The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Kavanaugh has the opinion of the court this morning in case 22-585, Cully against Marshall.
Under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, states ordinarily may not seize real property, for example, your house, that is subject to civil forfeiture, without first providing notice and a hearing. But states may immediately seize personal property, for example, a car, that is subject to civil forfeiture when the personal property otherwise could be removed, destroyed, or concealed before a forfeiture hearing. When states seize and seek civil forfeiture of personal property, due process requires only a timely post-seizure forfeiture hearing. In this case, petitioners Cully and Sutton loaned their cars to others, to a family member in one case and a friend in the other. Police officers in Alabama stopped the cars for traffic violations and discovered drugs in the cars. The officers arrested the drivers and seized the cars incident to the arrests. Because the cars apparently were used to commit or facilitate drug offenses, the state of Alabama filed a forfeiture complaint against Cully's car just 10 days after the seizure and brought a forfeiture case against Sutton's car 13 days after the seizure. While those forfeiture cases were ongoing, however, Cully and Sutton filed class action complaints in federal court. Both argue that a separate preliminary hearing before the forfeiture hearing was required under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Applying this court's due process precedents, the district court dismissed their complaints, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit affirmed. We granted review and now affirm the judgment of the 11th Circuit. Cully and Sutton argue that a separate preliminary hearing is constitutionally necessary to determine whether states may retain the seized personal property, here their cars, during the time before the ultimate forfeiture hearing. As they envision it, the preliminary hearing would focus on the probable validity of the forfeiture. The preliminary hearing would be adversarial. The parties could introduce evidence and cross-examine witnesses, and property owners could raise affirmative defenses, including innocent ownership. In essence, the preliminary hearing would be an earlier version of the forfeiture hearing itself. Alabama and the United States, as amicus curiae, disagree and argue that a preliminary hearing is not constitutionally required. To begin, they emphasize that most states and the federal government do not currently provide preliminary hearings in civil forfeiture cases like these. So requiring a preliminary hearing as a matter of constitutional dictate would cause a major change in the states and the federal government's longstanding practices. Alabama and the United States also contend that a property owner's post-seizure rights are already protected by the constitutional requirement from this court's cases, that the forfeiture hearing be timely. They further assert that requiring a hearing before a hearing in every case, as petitioners want, would interfere with important law enforcement activities that must occur after the seizure and before the forfeiture hearing, including coordinating forfeiture proceedings with related criminal investigations and ensuring that property is not removed, destroyed, or put to illegal use before the forfeiture hearing. Ultimately, we need not reweigh the competing due process arguments advanced by the parties because this court's decisions in a 1983 case, United States versus 8850, and a 1986 case, United States versus Von Neumann, already resolved the issue as we see it. In the 8850 case, the court held that a forfeiture hearing must be timely. In Von Neumann, in a case involving the federal government's civil forfeiture process, the court ruled that a timely forfeiture proceeding, without more, provides the post-seizure hearing required by due process to protect a plaintiff's property interest in a car. The court there explained that a plaintiff's right to a forfeiture proceeding that meets the 8850 timeliness test satisfies any due process right with respect to a car. Those precedents resolve this case. We hold that in civil forfeiture cases, the due process clause requires a timely forfeiture hearing, but does not require a separate preliminary hearing. In so ruling, we note that the states and Congress have adopted a variety of approaches to civil forfeiture, especially in recent years. For example, some states now require a jury trial. Still others condition civil forfeiture on a successful criminal prosecution, and a few now require preliminary hearings. Our decision today does not preclude those legislative innovations. Rather, our decision simply addresses the baseline protection of the Due Process Clause. Justice Gorsuch has filed a concurring opinion, which Justice Thomas has joined. Justice Sotomayor has filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson have joined.
Justice Kagan has our opinion this morning in case 22-1078, Warner Chapel Music versus Neely.
The Copyright Act encourages creativity by giving certain exclusive rights to the author of an original work. When someone violates those rights, a copyright owner can sue for infringement and get money damages. In this case, we consider whether there's a time limit on the damages that can be recovered over and above the normal time limit on bringing a suit. The story of this case begins decades ago. In 1983, Sherman Neely teamed up with a disc jockey named Tony Butler to start a music company. Their company recorded one album and several singles. But the collaboration dissolved a few years later, and soon afterward, Neely went to prison. While Neely was in prison, and unbeknownst to him, his supposed partner, Butler, entered into an agreement with Warner Chapel Music Company to license the Neely-Butler songs to other artists. And Warner Chapel found quite a few takers. The Neely-Butler music was remade into songs by artists you might know, like Flo Rida, the Black Eyed Peas, and Kid Sister. I can tell you're wondering whether I know about those artists. I'm not telling. When Neely got out of prison, he learned of Warner Chapel's activities, and he brought this lawsuit for copyright infringement. Neely claimed that he owned the copyrights to the original songs. Warner Chapel, he said, infringed those rights by selling the songs to others and now owed him money. Now, Neely's case involves two issues about timing, but we decide only one of them today. The first issue, the one we don't decide, is whether Neely's suit is timely. The Copyright Act says plaintiffs like Neely must sue within 3 years of when their claim accrued, and there are two different understandings of what that means. On one view, a person has to sue within 3 years of when an infringement took place. And if that's true, Neely is out of luck because the infringements he's complaining about go back a decade or more. But on another view, this view is called the discovery rule, a person need only sue within 3 years of when he discovered an infringing act. That means a plaintiff might be able to sue for some very old infringements if he only recently learned of them. And if that's the rule, all of Neely's claims could be timely, because he learned about the infringing conduct only once he was released from prison, which was less than 3 years before he sued. In this case, we assume that that's the rule, and so assume that Neely's suit was timely, even though it's for some very old infringements. We make that assumption mostly because Warner Chapel, the defendant here, didn't challenge use of the discovery rule in the courts below, and because courts of appeals generally do apply the discovery rule. That brings us to the second question, which you'll be glad to know we do decide. That question is, assuming a suit is timely, does the Copyright Act impose a separate 3-year limit on the recovery of damages? That's what Warner Chapel says, and a court of appeals that does a lot of copyright suits, the Second Circuit, has agreed with it. They argue that even though the discovery rule may allow Neely to bring suit for infringements that go back many years, he can recover money for only those infringements that occur in the 3 years before his lawsuit. Today, we reject that position. There is no such thing as a 3-year damages bar on a timely suit. So long as a plaintiff has a timely claim under the Copyright Act, he can get damages for it no matter when the infringement occurred. The text of the Copyright Act gives us that answer clearly. The Act's statute of limitation sets just one clock running, 3 years to bring a suit. There is no separate 3-year limit on damages. And the Act's provision on damages also do not provide for any time bar. So a copyright owner who has a timely suit for infringement can get money for it no matter when the infringement happened. Justice Gorsuch has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Thomas and Justice Alito join.
Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar of the court.
The counselor to the Chief Justice.
Judge Dow.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of James Lewis Quinn of the Bar of the State of Louisiana. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Quinn will be admitted.
Thomas Moore.
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Jonathan Lewis Gollinger of the Bar of the State of California. I'm satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Gollinger will be admitted.
Michelle Rosenthal.
Ms. Rosenthal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Samuel Jason Winokur of the Bar of the State of California. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Winokur will be admitted.
Damon Eisenbray.
Mr. Eisenbray.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Jacqueline W. Cooney of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied that she possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Ms. Cooney will be admitted.
Douglas Litvak.
Mr. Litvak.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Christopher Frederick Hamilton of the Bar of the State of Florida. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Hamilton will be admitted.
Jason Jones.
Mr. Jones.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Dana Janine Jones of the Bar of the State of North Carolina. I am satisfied she possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Ms. Jones will be admitted.
Andrew Richmond.
Mr. Richmond.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Diane Karen Richmond of the Bar of the State of New York. I am satisfied she possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Ms. Richmond will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from Fordham University School of Law, presented by Dean Matthew Diller.
Dean Diller.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From New Jersey, the Honorable Grace Yunmi Lee, Norman Michael Robertson. From New York, Douglas Michael Crockett, Veronica Nicole Dunlap, Adela Marie Hurtado, Anne Catherine Leahy, Krina Sushil Modi, David Moe, Yael Weinman. From Pennsylvania, Michael John Rant, and from Texas, Barbara Leal. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from New England Law Boston, presented by Albert Balboni.
Mr. Balboni.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the state of Colorado, Kara Noel Adams. From the District of Columbia, William Michael Ryder. From the state of Florida, Angelina M. Coloniso and Katie Marguerite Miller. From the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Lauren Michelle Bucci, Betsy J. Choate, Judith Ann Heller, Joan Marie Howard, Hugh Wynn, Lawrence Edward Patrick O'Brien, Rosanna Pacella, Wendy Ann Pacheco, Delence Pierre Luis, Donna Marie Pichotta, Letitia Raymond, Ashley Dorothea Roses, Nancy C. Statton, Mary Jean Stone, Krista Lynn Wallace, Carolina Weigel, from the state of New York, Lee Nicole Barrett, Erica Mason Francisco Law, Janet Ann Godolfo, Harry Shannon Katz, Cami Trebini Naran, from the state of Rhode Island, Regina Marie Costa, and from the state of Washington, Parker Nicole Reynolds. I'm satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Thursday, the 16th of May at 10 o'clock.